Good morning and welcome to the Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host Tim Henney. And yes, you heard it, just like station manager Larry Warren said, we are going to keep lines open during this hour for any calls that you may have regarding the fire. We want to keep lines open also for the fire officials. Of course, we have interviews with the Mountain Life, couple of great interviews today, and they fortunately are taped. So we'll be here, Tim and I, standing by and keeping, again, the phone lines open for any calls that may come our way. We spoke recently with the state spokesperson for the Rockport Fire, and we have more on those updates coming up in a little bit, but we'll go ahead and get started with our program. So good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Lynn. That's right. We're going to air several taped interviews, and we'll be standing by to take any calls regarding anything related to the fire. First, we're going to speak with farmer and rancher Peter Kosh of the Central Valley in California. He's someone who sees the water levels declining, the agricultural land being divvied up, and farming and ranching threatened in the area where most of our nation's fresh produce and many other foods come from. Kosh owns a calf ranch and an organic almond orchard, which gives him a diverse yet thorough understanding of farming and ranching practices in the Central Valley. He's an interesting guy with a perspective that's both informed and, frankly, scary. Stay tuned for that conversation.
And then we'll have a conversation with Grandmother Mona Palaka. She's one of 13 on the Distinguished Worldwide Grandmothers Council. It's a group of indigenous grandmothers from around the world. Grandma Mona will be coming to Park City on August 24th to the Shop Yoga Studio to talk about her role and our role in water conservation solutions, and she'll share her sacred wisdom as she does on the many UN committees she sits on and around the world at her lectures. That's all coming up in this hour, as we said, along with any updates to that Rockport fire that we feel that we need to share with the community. Of course, all of the fire agencies are saying stay tuned to KPCW because this is where you'll hear all of the information condensed, and any 911 calls or calls to Park City Fire Chief Paul Hewitt last night, he said tune into KPCW. That's where you'll hear the best updates. So stay with us. Stay tuned. This is the Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Jill Van Ostel, Spa Director at Stein Erickson Lodge Deer Valley, a proud supporter of KPCW Radio. Our Norwegian spa offers wellness classes, fitness facility, an outdoor pool with food and beverage service, treatment menus, and locally crafted product lines. 645-6475 or steinlodge.com.
I'm John Wells. Join us Thursday at 9 a.m. for Community Voices.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peek. We'll talk to you about issues in the news that matter to you.
That's Community Voices, Thursday at 9 a.m. on KPCW.
Brought to you by 350 Main and the Spur Bar and Grill. Welcome back to the Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host Tim Henney. Coming up next, we'll speak with Peter Kosh. He is a farmer in the Central Valley of California. I wanted to mention again that is a taped interview, so don't shy away from any calls that you may need to make to the station here, the number 655-8255, with any updates, any concerns you have about the Rockport fire. And that, of course, includes fire officials that we may be speaking with. Tim and I will be standing by. And this is a taped interview with Peter Kosh. Very interesting conversation with this very informed farmer from the Central Valley of California. Here's that interview now. The Central Valley of California has long been one of the agricultural bounty lands of this country, but as climate change and development pressure encroach on the viability of these farmlands, there are those on the ground fighting to preserve agriculture and the way of life. One of those is Peter Kosh, a calf rancher in the Central Valley near Merced, who has, over the years, diversified to stay current. He's now shifted into more sustainable farming practices, like his organic almond orchard, which he'll tell us about. And Peter Kosh, welcome to the Mountain Life.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show.
Let's start with maybe a description of what your farm is like in the Central Valley. And I take it you're considered to be in the San Joaquin Valley, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, what is a calf ranch? I've never even heard of a calf ranch before.
Okay, well, a calf ranch is a ranch that raises young female Holstein calves that will eventually be milk cows of America in 20 months. So they come to us and had a day old, and we feed them milk and we get them through all their childhood diseases, you might say. They actually probably have four different venues of issues, the first being the diarrhea time when they have different things just like a child has, and then they go from that to ear infections to sometimes mild upper respiratory problems like colds, and then they get into things like pink eye and ringworm, just like kids do. So basically, we get them through all those challenges, because today the dairy farmer is a farmer that wears many hats, and he doesn't have time to look after his young stock because of many, many other issues. Anything from breed, making sure that his animals are being bred, being milked properly, to making sure he has enough water to put on his fields to grow corn, or regulatory paperwork, immigration issues, it goes on and on and on. So basically, we found a niche, and that's what we do. Part of our business is raising these young female calves.
And Peter, you say you found a niche. I mean, is this something that you discovered, or has this been done before? Was there precedent? And how did it come about?
It came about in 1990. I met a young lady in Park City that said she wanted to live on a farm, and I said I wanted to live on a farm. So we decided to move forward with that dream, and we moved to Oregon. And I had sort of some family friends there that had some acreage, and they were raising young bull calves, which are Holstein bulls that are basically, at the time, they were Mecklenburgers. And they raised those up to about 1,000 pounds to 1,200 pounds, and they would go into hamburger and steaks. So we started doing that and realized very quickly we enjoyed raising these young animals, and we would basically raise 500 of them in 1 year, and then we would sell them all, and we would take a month vacation. And the last time we, I think in 93, we sold the last lot of cattle, and they ended up going down to California in a little town called Turlock. And we thought, what a strange name. So we ended up driving past Turlock, going to Southern California, and this was in March. The weather was 70 degrees and green and beautiful, and there were dairies everywhere, so we decided to move to the Central Valley in California. And we started raising some bulls here, and then the Mecklenburger was no longer fashionable, and there was a bit of a slump in the beef market in 1995, so we then converted over to raising the females, Holstein calves.
So you have then how many calves on your ranch at any one time?
Between 1,000 and 2,000.
In doing this, in raising calves, you've seen into sort of the inner world or maybe even the dark world of dairies in the Central Valley. And, you know, talk a little bit about what goes into an organic dairy versus a regular dairy, for example.
Okay, well, I don't want to say the dark side. I don't think there is a dark side. I think that there is perhaps different sides. And we have organic dairies and we have conventional. They call them conventional dairies. And a conventional dairy is basically a dairy that has a lot of its feed brought into it from all over the country. So we have a lot of transportation issues or costs, shall we say. The organic side of it is now being sort of legislated that these animals must have at least 120 days of exposure to pasture. So the organic side, on when we talk about milk, is perhaps more sustainable only if we have water. And that also now becomes an issue. If we don't have the water, then it no longer becomes sustainable. The conventional side is sustainable as long as we have a transportation and as long as we have a means of getting feed to the facilities.
Okay, so how does that affect with shrinking amounts of farmland with, you know, I know in your area, a new university, for example, took up a bunch of farmland. And, you know, if the organic movement is growing and gaining steam, yet you need all this farmland to be able to pasture the cows. How is this part of the struggle and the difficulty with balancing?
It's definitely a struggle. You know, the land values, we had the greatest speculation in the country. I mean, we always competed with some other city for first place when it came to house foreclosures. And that's put a lot of speculation on our land, a lot of the land that was purchased prior to 08 for land development is now what we call put into a holding pattern. And they'll put some almond trees, for example, or some other crops, the developers, they lease it out. And then as soon as the market turns around, this land will be converted into houses and pavement. The organic side of it, it doesn't really matter if it's organic or conventional. I mean, that's the whole ag side of it is being challenged by urbanization from the university and from just, you know, the scenario that we need growth to survive.
And Peter, how about the water tie-in? I know you guys have a large aquifer there that's been, I guess, depleted through the years. And is it being recharged, or is it a ever-decreasing resource?
Yeah, it's ever-decreasing. There's no effort. There's very little effort. I shouldn't say no effort. There's very little effort. You know, I think most people see that we are headed to a catastrophe, and nobody really wants to talk about it. It's very, very serious. If it continues another year what we've had, we will definitely have millions of acres of land going out of production, especially in the west side of the state and the south of the state. And I don't know. I mean, we try to reach, you know, there's always discussion about recharging the water here, but it just never seems to happen. I don't know why we can't all agree. I've been here for 20 years, and we are still talking about recharge. We're still talking about more capacity. I was at a city council meeting a year ago, and one of our city councilmen said that he's lived here his whole life, and they have actually said that they were going to run out of water 50 years ago, and he said, quote, "I still turn on the tap, and the water comes out, so I'm not too worried about it." This is what we're dealing with.
Right. And Peter, what, from your perspective, how long do you think the aquifer is going to continue to be able to sustain the level of agriculture that, you know, is in the balance right now? Are we talking 5 years, 15 or 25 or 55?
You know, it's a very hard question. I don't think anyone can answer that. I think all of the estimates are really guesstimates. They have some ideas of where we are really losing water. The general census is 10 to 20 years, we will see some significant change in how much food is produced here.
And what's the water going towards? What sort of, is it crop or is it animal or is it residential? I mean, obviously there's a residential component, but let's talk about the ag component. What sort of agriculture is being irrigated?
Well, there's 300 varieties of crops that are grown here, commodities. So there's not one specific. The largest one would probably be almonds today. It is growing at a tremendous rate. The speculation on almonds by developers, people who are not in agriculture, like I said before, are speculating that almonds were they're relatively an easy tree to grow and to manage. Not a lot of labor involved. So, and it's a one-time harvest, you know, once a year. But most of the water is going for tree crops, I would probably say. And then you have probably going to be corn. And but we do pistachios. There's a lot of walnut trees. There's everything. I mean, the diversity, it will just blows your mind. It's just incredible if you're into food and agriculture to see the diversity here. So the water is not particularly used for one item. It would probably be the trees would be the most usage now. They're actually in a decline because of the you know, the pricing they have and, you know, all of that kind of those issues.
Is the agriculture that's grown in the Central Valley, is it regional? I mean, are there some areas that are all artichokes and then some areas that are all almond tree areas?
Yeah. Definitely the south of the valley, you would see, you'll see almonds go all the way up from, let's say, Bakersfield all the way into Sacramento Valley. So the almond is pretty large area here. But citrus would be more to the, like, you know, Fresno area, Fresno South, and artichokes and your lettuce towards the coast.
Now, Peter, you have diversified quite a bit from the calf ranch. You still have that operation, but you've moved into organic almond farming. I guess you call it. Do you call it farming?
Yes.
Okay. And you have several orchards there. Is that right?
We have one main orchard, and then we have some little 10-acre pieces. We're playing with pomegranates right now.
Oh, fun. You talk to me about some interesting things I had no idea of regarding almonds. So you raise organic almonds, and one of the things that you don't do to them is pasteurization, which I had no idea even happened to almonds. Can you talk about that a little bit, the pasteurization and lack thereof?
A little history. I guess when the food supply, as the population on planet Earth grows, we have to produce more food. And the more food we produce, the more transportation, the more hands that handle it, the chance for food-borne illness increases. And I don't know the exact numbers, but it actually can increase quite a bit. And so what they've done to prevent some of this is they do the pasteurization of almonds. It's to prevent an outbreak. They don't want the industry to have an outbreak. There was, I believe, a salmonella outbreak. Maybe it's 10 years ago now, 8 years ago. I think it was some almonds that came from California that went into Canada. With the technology, they were able to actually pinpoint the orchard that it came from. And what they found was that the orchard is a conventional orchard, which is not organic. And they had grown the trees to a size that didn't allow any sunlight to hit the ground. So basically, you have a sterilized bottom, or let's say an orchard floor that is sterilized. There's no grass growing. There's no insects, no sunlight. A rodent, a bird, can drop some feces, and it can proliferate. And that's what they believe, because I believe the salmonella was typo to a avian type. In our orchard, which is organic, we have sunlight, we have grass, we have lots of bugs in our natural occurring bugs. If you were to sit in my orchard within 15 seconds, you will notice life. And life will be everything from ants and flies to wasps, bees, and beetles, spiders. It is an incredible ecosystem. We just never take the time to look at it or appreciate it. But our disease pressure is very low. Our yield is not what a conventional orchard is. We don't get the tonnage per acre. But neither do we have to spray the amount of pesticides or herbicides, and we just don't have the disease challenge. It's much more symbiotic, you might say, with the environment. Pasteurization is an attempt to prevent any type of food illness, and there is debate that we do know when you do heat up a nut, whether it's a peanut or an almond or a walnut, you convert the healthy fats towards a unhealthy fat, a saturated fat. Not by a large amount, but you are starting to manipulate the fat in the nut. So that's kind of what some of the organic people would try to promote their product for not being pasteurized. It's the number one reason why we don't want to pasteurize. It's the health part of it.
Right. So, but currently, if I go to Whole Foods, say, and I buy organic almonds, they will be pasteurized.
They will be pasteurized.
Okay, so this is the next question, maybe about how we're tending towards, returning to more farmers markets and more food co-ops and this sort of thing. That's where your market is, right? That's where your niche is with organic almonds that are non-pasteurized.
Correct. We call them CSA, community supported agriculture. Our nuts go into a box. We do have some that are pasteurized, and they go through a handler, and we don't know where they go. But a percentage of our nuts do go to farmers markets and to these CSAs.
Okay, so the only way I'm going to get your almonds in my hand is if I invite you here on a ski vacation.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then, Peter, who is lucky enough? Who are the CSAs? And is there a big enough market around your immediate area? Or do you provide product to farmer markets that go as far as the Oakland and San Francisco area?
Okay. Well, we haven't touched on the eggs. We have chicken eggs, too. But those eggs do reach Los Angeles. Our nuts, I believe, would stay more in our local area. We do have two CSAs in Merced County. I don't know. I don't think that's unusual. I think every county in California has at least one CSA, and I think as you get closer to the more urbanized areas, you'll have multiple CSAs.
So let's talk a little bit about eggs. You know, you were telling me about the difference between, you know, what we, when we go to buy eggs in the grocery store, we've got, you know, cage free, which means one thing that is something different than I thought it meant, and distinguish between the different types of eggs and what they really mean.
Okay, well, the egg market, and I presume all markets are similar when you're trying to sell a product, but the eggs really kind of took me for a loop. Free range means, definition by, I believe, the USDA, is that the chickens can spread their wings. They're still in a cage, but they can spread their wings. Cage free means that a chicken is not in a cage, but it's in a big house with 20,000 other chickens. And you have organic and you have pasture fed. And organic is birds that are fed organic grain. Organic soybean, organic corn is primarily the main ingredient. And then you have pasture fed, which what we do. And that means we offer the chickens to have organic grain, but they're out on pasture, so they are out eating grass and bugs. When you get into animals, I think if you're really concerned about your health, you want, I wouldn't necessarily say organic is the all. It's pasture fed. You want animals that have been on pasture. The grass is what they're meant to eat. They're not meant to eat corn and soybean. This is not how they were intended to eat. They're big methane, cows, especially big methane digesters. But the pastured feed is just absolutely incredible. The birds taste different. Their eggs are incredible. I mean, we cannot make enough or produce enough eggs. People, once they've had them, just are crazy for them. One man described the yolks as molasses. And you have to obviously like yolks if you want to eat these eggs. And a lot of people do like yolks. So,
Peter, what's the challenge here? I mean, you know, it seems like it makes so much sense that we have this industrial food complex that is really not a sustainable for a long period of time way to treat animals and produce food. And there seems to be a lot of evidence that's kind of coming to that conclusion. Then we have the organic and the pasture movement and ranchers and farmers like yourself. And it all makes so much sense. The food tastes better. The animals are treated better. So is this a temporary shift? Because, you know, the economics at work here are always going to be behind the industrial food complex and not supporting you. And at some point, the land doesn't work either. There has to be more land to do the way you do it, to pasture your animals, to pasture everything, to create the right kind of orchard for your almonds. It takes a lot more land.
Yeah. No, you're right. And so what's your question?
My question is it possible to shift the collective consciousness, create the demand for the type of food you're talking about and you're providing, or do we hit this wall of we don't have enough water, we don't have the right resources, we don't have water resources, and we don't have land resources, therefore we are stuck with industrial production?
You're right. We are going to hit the wall. There's no doubt in my mind that We're head on, and it's sad. You know, I have friends who are, you know, who meet with the big boys, and I'm talking about the big corporations in Chicago, and they talk about how they're going to process food and sell food to the masses, and they are predicting in 7 years that we will start seeing food shortages in our grocery stores. And it's going to be very gradual. It's not going to be, you know, alarming. But, for example, we don't have apples today. They'll be in next Monday. And bananas, they're a little behind. And there's no ground beef, but we do have some turkey left. And there'll be little things like this, little subtle, because the population on planet Earth is going to outgrow what we can produce if we want to have what we have today. We have no idea how privileged we are when we go to a grocery store. You can go walk through the door and not really know what you want to eat, but you can go to any grocery store in this country and you can have anything you want. You know that. It's there. It's 365 days a year. And if you had any idea of the heartache and the heartbreak that it took to get the food there, plus how much food doesn't fit through the screen or is not the right size or the right shape or the right color, it's amazing how much is discarded. But we are going to see a time here in the next decade where we won't have the selection or the quality, because it will either leave this country for higher markets, China primarily, India, they are definitely switching their diets from rice and beans to meat and dairy products. This is something they like. So it's going to hit the wall. There's not enough pasture. There's not enough water.
And you've been growing your ranch over the years. You started with the calving operation, and now you're into the almond and the eggs and the chickens. And so how has your ranch grown, and are you continuing to acquire ranch land, and is there a conservation and preservation motive there, or is it simply to be able to pasture more animals and have better orchards?
Well, because I'm not very optimistic of the future, and especially here in California, the water supply being sort of the Achilles heel here, I'm really not looking to get in more debt for more land, not knowing there's enough water. I know some people, I mean, that's my personality. I don't feel comfortable getting into that kind of a debt load to try to do more. We have two types of water systems here in California we didn't touch on. We do have the groundwater pumping, which sort of is supposed to be a backup for when we don't get enough snow in the mountains. Then that's what we used, you know, winter snow melt in our reservoirs, and we use that as irrigation. And California is probably the most sophisticated irrigation system on planet Earth and manipulated waterways on planet Earth. But that is where we are today. So
yeah, it sounds pretty dire, really. Peter, I wanted to ask you, when you read books like John Robbins' Food Revolution and Michael Pollan, the In Defense of Food, and books like that, I mean, they're not farmers, and you are. Does your view differ from theirs?
No, it doesn't. Especially Michael Pollan, I think he's right on. His Omnivore's Dilemma book was enlightening for me, who's in agriculture. I was expecting to read some of his work to be perhaps, on the other wacko side, but he was right on. He had enough science in there to prove his point, and he was correct. I know he tries to be debunked quite a bit in our world, but he's right on.
Our guest is Peter Kosh. He is a calf rancher, an almond farmer. What else?
A chicken farmer. Pomegranate farmer.
And a family man and the owner of Nicholas Calf Ranch. And Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, it was a pleasure being with you. Thank you.
And it is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney, and we'll be right back. Stay with us.
The Egyptian Theater and the Neil Simon Festival present Lost in Yonkers, a play by Neil Simon, August 15th through the 18th. The New York Daily News called this one of Simon's most impressive and funniest plays. It's touching and poignant, clever and witty. Tickets start at just $23 and are available at parkcityshows.com or 649-9371. The Egyptian Theater is a dramatically different nonprofit organization.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, Vice President and Branch Manager at Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch. We're proud to support KPCW. Grand Valley Bank is pleased to announce the Deer Valley Wednesday Night Community Concert Series through August 28th with Utah-based musicians. For schedules, deervalley.com or 435-615-2265. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Coming up, a conversation with grandmother Mona Palaka. She's one of 13 on the Distinguished Worldwide Grandmothers Council. It's a group of indigenous grandmothers from around the world. Grandma Mona will be coming to Park City on August 24th to the Shop Yoga Studio to talk about her role and our role in water conservation solutions. She'll be sharing her sacred wisdom as she does on the many UN committees she sits on and around the world at her lectures. And before we welcome her, I just want to give a quick update on the fire. Our most recent reports have that fire is at 2,000 acres. They've done some GPS mapping from above and established before we heard maybe 4,000 acres, but it's 2,000 acres. Oh, some 13 structures have been destroyed, and 250 homes are still threatened at this point. Now, along with the fire escort, while the fire is calm right now, they are allowing some residents from the Rockport Estates to go up and get medicine and animals. But that is just on a case-by-case basis. So that's kind of where it is now. They are worried that when winds resume, and it is a little breezy out there right now, but when winds kick up right around midday, they're worried that the fire is going to come back up as well. And of course, we will be keeping you informed with updates here on KPCW. It is where you can come to get all the updates and all the news on that fire. We have all the fire officials from the interagencies calling in to keep us informed so we can keep you informed. So heading back into the mountain life, healthy living in the Wasatch, we're coming up, we'll speak with grandmother Mona Palaka, but first we're going to welcome Heather DeFord. She is a Park City resident, and she was the one who was instrumental in getting grandmother Mona to come to Park City on August 24th to the Shop Yoga Studio for a talk. So Heather DeFord will have her talk a bit right now. Again, this is a taped interview. We can break in if there's any breaking news about the fire.
We're really excited that Grandma Mona is here to represent the International Council of 13 Indigenous Grandmothers. Their movie is called For the Next Seven Generation, and it is about their inception and how this group of women came to be. It's a very auspicious story. It's a beautiful story. So since then, since 2004, the grandmothers have been meeting for their council meetings twice a year and attending various UN committees, writing books, founding organizations on healing the planet, water conservation, educating our children, retaining sacred wisdom and retaining indigenous wisdoms. So it'll be nice that she will be there to speak to what events have occurred since the movie has been made. And we've invited some local conservation groups, Nancy Mesner from the Logan area. She is going to be able to speak to some local water issues. She is a water quality specialist. We're also going to have some live music and some information tables on other ways that we can be a part of the solution on water conservation.
And so Heather, maybe what you can just tell us is how it is that you have found so much meaning and what it's like to attend a council meeting.
Great. That's a great question. So these women have gathered from all over the world to one place, and they gather in one of the grandmother's home place. And they meet for 4 days, 4 to 5 days, and morning, noon, and night, one grandmother will offer a prayer ceremony from their home place, from their tribe. And, you know, whether it be a peace pipe or a channeling or a water blessing or plant brushing. So it's been amazing to see these women from the Arctic Circle, the Amazon, from Tibet and Nepal offer and share their prayer with us. You know, morning, noon, and night. It was an amazing experience.
And so you've been going to these council meetings for about 7 years, is that
right? I mean, unfortunately, I've only gone to 3 of the 7. They've been all around the world. So I was able to attend the one in India for Grandma Serene. She's a Tibetan grandmother in asylum there. And the one in Oregon for Grandma Agnes, and the one in Arizona with Grandma Mona was hosting that event.
Okay. And what do you see when you attend these council meetings? Obviously, it draws a lot of people who also want to heal the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And it serves as inspiration, but it also serves as some sort of call to action. Is that right?
Yes. I think, you know, in the beginning stages, it wasn't clear of why these women were gathering. There was just a huge yes, we need to gather. And as time has gone on, it did become clear that these events were an amazing networking opportunity for like-minded people. So women from all over the world and men would come to these events to learn about local issues in that area and global issues. So people would walk away with a lot of awareness and some action-oriented possibilities of how they can be a part of the solution. So when I remember being in Sedona, Arizona, for Grandmothers Mona. There's people from the local tribes there talking about their struggles with water rights. And I just left there having so much more of appreciation for my own water usage. And from that experience, I just became, you know, a better steward of the earth.
Thank you for that, Heather DeFord. We now have Grandmother Mona Palaka standing by, joining us on the phone. It's a pleasure to have you, Grandma Mona, and welcome to the Mountain Life.
Thank you.
Just to begin with, for those who are not familiar with the International Council of 13 Indigenous Grandmothers, maybe you could just give us a quick overview.
Okay. I'm a member of the International Council of 13 Indigenous Grandmothers, and we were established in October 2004. There was a gathering of women to have dialogue in a place called the Menla Retreat Center in New York, in Phoenicia, New York, and there were Indigenous women from around the world that were invited to come to meet with Western women to have dialogue about our concerns about the issues facing the world that we felt that we needed to talk about and begin to possibly chart some plans for addressing them. Okay. And so the Center for Sacred Studies, along with others who had talked about putting this conference together, they created their invitations for the Indigenous women based on suggestions that were given to them by various individuals who had a relationship with the Center for Sacred Studies as well as some of the other organizers. And there were about 16 or 17 invitations that were sent out to these Indigenous women who were invited. And of these invitations, there were 13 grandmothers who were who accepted the invitation and attended. And so this is how we initially came together. There were no plans to create a council. However, after spending the days together, the Indigenous grandmothers, we found that we all had similar concerns in among our peoples in the different places we came from.
And we
talked.
Oh, sorry. I just wanted to point out to our listeners that the 13 Indigenous grandmothers come from really all over the world: Mexico, Nicaragua, Brazil, Africa, Tibet, Nepal, Canada, and then along with several from the states here, Oregon, Alaska, Montana, is that right? South Dakota, and you're from Arizona.
Yes, yes. We have a Tibetan grandmother who is originally from Tibet, but is now in exile and lives in Canada.
Right.
And so, yes, we are from all different parts of the world, and we had come to this meeting, this gathering, and in talking about these concerns we had, there was a call to, well, where we can't come together and just talk about this and then walk away. We must continue to, we must plan on doing, you know, taking action and furthering, you know, the dialogue.
I'm curious about the aspect of the feminine in Indigenous societies. And the question that comes to mind is, why 13 Indigenous grandmothers? Why not 13 Indigenous elders that have both grandfathers and grandmothers, or why not 13 Indigenous grandfathers? How did it become grandmothers?
Well, because of the, in the teachings or traditional teachings of Indigenous people, the grandmothers are in somewhat of a position of of authority in as far as there's a saying that says that the grandmothers or the women are the ones who hold the life, so being that they are the ones who bear life, and that grandmothers or women are at this time, according to many of the traditional teachings and prophecies, say that this is the time when the women will step forward to begin to activate their responsibility in maintaining balance in the world.
And those prophecies, do you believe that your council that has come together was part of the manifestation of some of these ancient and traditional prophecies?
Well, based on the some of the grandmothers who came to the gathering, there were instructions that had been given. Let's say, for instance, like the grandmother from Alaska, who was given her instructions when she was around 7, 8 years old, and given a bundle that where she was told by her grandmother that she is to hold the bundle for the 13 grandmothers. And so this was fulfillment. When we gathered Grandmother Rita Pitka Blumenstein, she opened her bundle and she said, "I've been holding these for the 13 grandmothers. I didn't know what my grandmother was talking about, but now I look around and you must be the 13 grandmothers that I was told to deliver this bundle to." And so there have been other people who have come forward and have told us that there had been stories or oral history that had said that there would come a time when grandmothers would come forward and speak, and that these teachings would, the speaking of the grandmothers would be to remind humanity of the need to come together in a more balanced way of living on Mother Earth.
Grandmother Mona, I read on the website that the grandmothers had, I read something about how they had been contacted through the astral plane. And have each of you received some form of a message that have drawn you together? And do each of you see this as kind of the manifestation that you just spoke about?
Well, I can tell you that many of the grandmothers have that gift to receive messages through visions or through the dreams, and so I think that we feel that what we say is that we didn't put ourselves in the seat to be part of the grandmother's council. It was spirit driven that this happened. There are other factors. I mean, things like the sacred fire that we use, and some of the, training or preparation that had been given to us throughout our life to be involved in caring for our people and upholding the responsibilities to preserve and protect our traditions and earth-based medicine.
And so I'm curious about some of the projects that you've done around the world. If you look into it, you've been recently, maybe this year even, in Germany and New Zealand, the Grand Canyon, France, and in different places in southern Mexico and Guatemala. And I'm wondering, when you visit these places, I know that just one grandmother or maybe several at a time go, but what are the what's the thrust of the projects that you're working on? Can you talk a little bit about some of the projects, and we can tie that into what you're going to be doing when you come to Park City?
One of the key projects that we're involved in is water. Water as a sacred element, and basically all of the elements being described as sacred, and the teachings that go along those lines of respecting the water, respecting our air, respecting the fire and Mother Earth. Those kind of teachings, and they're, you know, what we call basic consciousness or basic teachings that all peoples, not just indigenous, but all of life on Mother Earth are dependent mm-hmm. on these basic elements, and that life is sacred. And so this is the work that we've been doing, and that goes along with what our mission is, again, to create awareness among all peoples about the importance of having a relationship and a understanding with the basic elements of life.
Grandma,
and so that's the work we've been doing.
Grandmother Mona, sometimes on some of the information that I've read, I see a lot of talk about healing, praying for the healing of the damage that's been done to the earth. And then in some respects, I see some of the things that you talk about as kind of projecting forward for the next seven generations. Are they part and parcel of the same mission on the part of the grandmothers, or is there an emphasis on praying and healing the damage to the earth versus what we can do and the vision that we're trying to create for the future?
Well, we don't see them as separate entities. We see them as whole. The praying could not necessarily be, you know, actually sitting there and praying. Praying could be how you behave, how you conduct yourself, how you respect these elements or the places in the world, how you care for them, how you actually, in some cases, protect it.
Again, I'd like to kind of explore the connection of the feminine to this realignment to the sacred elements of the earth versus Western culture, which tends to be more of a masculine-driven culture and society. Is that part of the issue here, is trying to bring back the indigenous feminine mission in the face of what has happened over the last, you know, couple of centuries with sort of this Western male-dominated society?
It's, I guess in a way, it's sort of like a the kind of meanings that we attach to this kind of thinking. In indigenous societies, the role and the responsibility is shared. It's not separate. It's shared between male and female, or masculine and feminine. And one of the concerns we have is that given that we all are made up of masculine and feminine, it's creating this awareness that that as a human being, that it's important to be conscious and aware of your own relationship, beginning with yourself, your own relationship of what you are, who you are, where did you come from? And so these are some of the basic understandings that we're indigenous people are saying we must come back to, getting back to the basic understanding and awareness of ourselves as a living being. And it has really, there's no lines that are being drawn between masculine and feminine. We don't see that as even being possible, because we too have been born from a male and a female union.
And And that is Grandmother Mona Palaka. She'll be coming to Park City on August 24th to speak at the Shop Yoga Studio. Along with her talk there will be the airing or the screening of the film, the documentary, The Next Seven Generations, highlighting the story of these 13 Indigenous grandmothers from around the world. You're listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
As the world evolves, so do our roles. At the Intermountain, Park City, Bonanza, and Round Valley Clinics, we have defined ours for you. I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino, and excited to announce that the Bonanza Clinic is now a full-time InstaCare, exclusively for the urgent medical needs of our community. Our great partners at the Round Valley Clinic will now be the primary care experts. We are happy to provide expert care close to home. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, this is Eric Karshner, Assistant General Manager of Park Meadows Country Club, sponsor of The Mountain Life on KPCW. Park Meadows Country Club is the only in-town private country club just minutes from historic Main Street. Golf, social, and dining memberships are available. 649-2460 or on the web at parkmeadowscc.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I want to thank our guest today, Peter Koch. He's the farmer and rancher from the Central Valley of California. Also, Heather DeFord, Park City resident, who is hosting Grandmother Mona Palaka at the August 24th talk there at the yoga studio, the Shop Yoga Studio. I want to also thank our underwriters.
Prudential Utah Real Estate, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, the Park City Clinic, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank, and our friend Daryl English back at Grand Valley doing what he does best, and Park Meadows Country Club.
That's right. And thanks to for listening and joining us for The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with my co-host, Tim Henney. And finally, before we go and head back into NPR News, want to just give a quick update on the fire. All we've heard in the last hour is that they're now starting to drop more fire retardant again on the fire. Now, that's resuming from last night. While it's been calm so far this morning, winds are picking up a bit. While they were letting some residents go in on a case-by-case basis in the Rockport Estates area, right now it's only under an extreme emergency that residents would need to get in to either get a dog or another animal that was at the residence or perhaps some needed medicine. So again, it's just under an extreme emergency that they would be letting anyone back in, and that would be with the fire escort. You've been listening to The Mountain Life. We'll be right back.
How high can you go? How far can you push yourself? Take the Adventure Course Challenge at the Utah Olympic Park, featuring three new adventure courses for all levels and ages. Plus, don't miss the Ultimate Gravity Challenge on the 60-foot drop tower. Do it all when you get the new Adventure Pass for $40. Your pick of three adventures in a day. For passes and tickets, go to UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional, FHA, and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay tuned now for National Public Radio news from Washington, followed by music. And we will have more updates on that fire. It's not contained at this point, but it has calmed down overnight, and they're just keeping an eye on it now. You're listening to KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City.